Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Commission on Housing Affordability. We welcome everyone who is with us in person and who is also joining online this afternoon. Today is Tuesday, September the 5th, 2023. We're beginning at approximately 1:09 p.m. here in the State Capitol building. We appreciate everybody's work and preparation for today. We'll be following the agenda that is outlined, that is posted. We'll begin with public comments, seeing if there is anyone here with us in person that would like to share a public comment. We do have one. We'll invite you to come forward, and then we'll go online to see if there's anyone online that would also like to share a public comment. As you come to the stand, we ask you to please introduce yourself, your position, and the organization that you're representing. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Cameron Dale, Executive Director of the Utah League of Cities and Towns. I mainly just wanted to give you an update on league timing and process, because tomorrow will be our annual convention, and many of the topics that are before the CHA over the last few weeks, we will be discussing with our membership at the convention over the next few days later this week. So I just wanted to give a quick update on that timing. I know the Association of Counties also have a conference this week, and so look forward to more dialogue as the month progresses.
Thank you very much for sharing that information with everyone. Is there any comment from anybody online at this time? Seeing none, have we received any comment written prior to this meeting? We have not, so we will close public comment portion of the agenda and move forward. We're going to move the approval of meeting minutes towards the end of this meeting to ensure we have a quorum. So we are now at the fourth item on the agenda, which we will... Okay, we're going to adjust the order just a little bit here. Before we move forward with the Libertas Institute presentation, we'll move to the working group funding update and appreciate Wayne Niederhauser with us joining online, and we'll turn the microphone to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the slides available, or do I share a screen?
Yes, it looks like they're being pulled up right now.
Thank you. Okay. Let's go to the next slide. All right, so I just want to, this is a familiar slide. The recent Kent Gardner Institute report, we have an extreme deficit in deeply affordable housing. This wasn't a big surprise, but I mean, we got 3 units per 100 households in this space. So it should be paramount that we approve and move on some successful programs we've already started. Let's go to the next slide. You know, this is the housing model I've been showing throughout the last couple of years. It is the right housing model. You need to have the housing, you got to have support. And in order for you to have housing, you got to have LIHTC, you have to have gap funding, you have to have rent support. Let's go to the next slide. And so, you know, the deeply affordable housing grants, we have, we're very successful in last year with the $55 million that was given the Office of Homeless Services. We received $168 million in requests. I've shown you the list of those who received those grants. Let's go to the next slide. This is the result of the this year's grant process. We had almost $50 million. We had $105 million in requests. And we have the similar outcomes statewide with spreading this money to create more deeply affordable housing. Let's go to the next slide. Attainable housing grants this year, there's $5 million that we received. We had $2 million in requests. There is a lot of, there's been some misunderstanding regarding this program. But now that we're getting this information out to our housing authorities, I think that we'll be able to now go out for another grant process and put that whole $5 million to work for support. Let's go to the next slide. I guess we're missing a couple of slides there, but our request this year for Deeply Affordable is $50 million again, that we hope to get approved to get through the CHA and through the UEOC process. We're requesting $15 million ongoing like we did for more attainable housing grants. And then there's a request for $2.5 million in mitigation funds. Now, this isn't really necessarily directly related to housing, but is very important to the homeless situation. Mitigation funds give shelter cities the ability to mitigate the impact of a shelter in their city. This is how we funded last year. And the way we've set it up now, statutorily, is that, or at least in concept, is that 50% would be paid by the state, 50% would be paid by a redistribution of sales tax with the cities. And the cities have stepped up with some additional money this last year. The state put in one-time money to match that, $2.5 million. So we're now asking for $2.5 million ongoing to continue that commitment that we've made. Are there any questions on the mitigation? That's a new item that we're running through the CHA. And then lastly, again, let's go to the next slide. There's a huge ongoing need in homeless services across the state. Wages have been going up at an extreme level. I think everybody's been feeling that. We never really funded the resource centers the way they needed to be, and we're expanding shelter across the state. There's Utah County and Davis County are now required to come up with a winter plan for shelter beginning next year. So there's going to need to be some additional funding that we're going to need. We're calculating it to be at $39 million ongoing. This would catch us up and get us up to date and provide the needs that we need that are required for homeless services across the state, and that's not just Salt Lake County, but across the state. So that slide has changed just a little bit. The $8.7 million is part of the $21 million unfunded statewide. We're faced this year with even closing some beds when we're actually needing more beds. And we're not saying this should come out of the general fund, but we're looking for a dedicated funding source to help fund this. Is it a local option? Is it an increase in the margin for alcohol? Having been on the street a lot, alcohol is a big problem for people that are experiencing homelessness. So there's a nexus in just doing something like that. But the dedicated funding source is still being worked on. But this is something we still wanted to forward on through the CHA and then also through the UEOC. So happy to take any questions.
Thank you for the presentation. Is this kind of conclude the presentation from the funding?
Yes.
Working group?
Well, I think there's other, is there some other ones, Christina, other than ours?
Correct, there are. Thank you.
Okay.
Before we proceed to the other deck and presentation, are there any questions or clarifications from what was just explained?
Senator Fillmore.
Hi, Wayne. Thanks for this. I'd like your opinion on something. You know, we hope today to put our stamp of approval on some version of these funding recommendations. And at this point, I think these recommendations are going to the governor for inclusion in the governor's budget, and they are not at this point going to the legislature or the Executive Appropriations Committee for inclusion in the actual budget. If that were the case, then I would say we definitely ought to provide some guidance to EAC about what we find most important of these, so that, you know, if we assume that we're not going to get everything we're asking for, then what are the ones that we consider to be vital and maybe less vital, right? Which of our favorite children are we going to sacrifice in order to save the others of our more favorite children? Is that necessary to in the governor's budget?
Well, the governor's budget will be a refining process. Yes, we've made these requests into the governor's budget. We're also seeing them through this UEOC process, which also informs the legislature. The governor's budget informs the legislature. And so, yeah, my guess is these will be refined and maybe even reprioritized somewhat.
So I think, Wayne, that it would be a good idea to prioritize these coming out of this committee. And let me tell you one reason why. For me, the top priority is the $15 million in ongoing for the attainable housing grants. We asked for that in the governor's budget last year. The governor's budget included five. And therefore, your office, constrained by the governor's budget reality, could only ask for $5 million. Even though I really would love to have had the 15. I would like to prioritize the attainable housing grants high and at the full amount that we want, hoping that they'll be included in the governor's budget, hoping that that will inform the UEOC process, and if that makes sense. And in saying that, I would love to have the funding group's guidance about what the priorities are, right? At this point, I'm looking at a list. And I'd love to see some priorities on there. And if you could provide guidance about what are the two or three items from the homeless section that you think are most important, and then I would say to Christine, anybody else that's going to present, what do you think are the most important, so that we can prioritize those highly and provide that guidance to the people that are going to decide whether this goes or is reduced or eliminated from a budget or a budget request.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's hard to, you know, to say, I think these are all important. we've had success with the following, you know, the Olene Walker Fund. That's been an ongoing program for many years. It's highly utilized. Attainable housing grants is fairly new, but rent support is going to be key to any kind of success with housing, as you articulated. And then, of course, deeply affordable housing has been the $50 million. We've already proven that to be well worth those funds and getting more units on the ground. So if we're going to, with the projects that we already know are working, Housing Preservation Fund has been around for a couple of years. We've had them present. You know what that is. The shelter mitigation is something that really isn't a housing issue. Neither is the homeless dedicated funding. But they're really mainly here as a pass-through to the UEOC. So, anyway, it's hard for me to just say this is number one. They're all needed if we're going to address affordable housing. And then those two that I mentioned, they're really more of a operations versus a housing issue, but are going through the CHA just to get to the UEOC process.
What is the total one-time request, and what is the total ongoing request amounts?
Well, there'd be $75 million one time, and then 10, 15, 30 ongoing if you take out the shelter mitigation and dedicated funding source for homeless services. You know, if you include those in, it's, you know, over $40 million more.
Christina.
Wayne, just to be clear, it says $50 million for one-time funding. You said 75. Is there a number missing?
The Utah Housing Preservation Fund.
Oh, okay. I apologize. I thought you were just looking at homeless services.
No, I'm including everything under this slide.
Thank you.
Is there further discussion or questions?
So are we going to need to send a priority list then, you think?
No, I'm happy to do it, Wayne.
Okay.
Let's see. I'm not.
Better you than me.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I did have a question in your totals, Wayne, and it sounded like you were focused on the Office of Homeless Services and then the Utah Housing Preservation Fund. Is that correct on your totals?
Well, the totals that the chair asked me to come up with, I was just adding them up on this slide. So I'm trying to combine everything that's on this slide, not just Office of Homeless Services.
Oh, great. Thank you. Because I'm looking at the Olin Walker Housing Loan Fund, the gap financing piece of $10 million. I wasn't sure, based on what I heard, that was an included amount for ongoing, so I just wanted to clarify.
So the supportive housing for $5 million ongoing, I don't know what that is. We can cross that one off.
Wayne, tell attainable housing, tell me what the definition in your mind of attainable housing is. I think in a conversation you and I had earlier, you had equated that with permanent supportive housing. Is that different?
No, it's the same. It provides rent support. So it's like the HUD vouchers. It'll function like that and provides a rent flow to make the project viable.
And some of
those funds can flow through to services that are not paid by other funds like Medicaid.
And so that's my favorite one. Last year we asked for 15 out of this group. We got 5 from the governor and I think 5 from the legislature. And here we're asking for another 15.
Yes.
Okay.
But again, that top one, I'm not sure what that one is. Might be just duplicated. So we can cross.
I'm going to call it permanent supportive housing instead of attainable housing. Is that okay with you?
Yes. We don't care what it's called.
I do. Permanent supportive housing is more marketable.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. It appears we have a comment or a question online, and I believe it might be David Damshin. If that's you, David, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a kind of a comment slash question, and I appreciate Senator Fillmore, your comment. I think it was last year we used the term attainable to sort of demarcate commitments to homeownership. It was like the other end of the spectrum. So I think it probably better for clarity's sake that we've moved in the direction as you've suggested, Mr. Co-Chair. We have this data that's being finalized from Mackenzie Gardner Policy Institute that gives us more of a striation in or definitions, I guess, by income level, by percent, you know, as measured by percent of AMI. That kind of measures the deficiency in housing supply by income level. And I think we're going to see the final data somewhere in the December timeframe. Christina, I'm sure, knows more about that than I do. But I think that data suggests that based on construction activity and other factors, the dearth of housing supply units is less pronounced when you get up into the 80 to 100% and over 100% of AMI realm, whereas the magnitude of supply deficiency is quite large at the lower income levels. And I just wanted to point out that your quote, favorite unquote, Senator Fillmore, this 15 million, that's dedicated to the very most vulnerable. And so I think I guess I'm just saying the data that we're seeing, at least the preliminary data we've seen from Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute, would maybe encourage us in some ways to really focus on that very low end of the spectrum in terms of the supply deficiency and the need for additional commitment of resources. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion or questions regarding the presentation from Wayne Niederhauser? Yes, please proceed.
Yeah, Nate McDonald with Department of Workforce Services. I just wanted to address the last bullet on there since this is addressing some of the staffing needs. If you recall, I think everyone knows that over the last 3 years, a lot of action has been taken to support housing that has been placed, you know, whether it's funding different projects that have gone through the Housing and Community Development Division, and then also the changes on the moderate income housing plan. And so this is really a request to support the changes that have been made over the last 2 years, the workload that has happened with the moderate income housing plans and the work that is needed to work with all the municipalities is more than one staff. And so that's the request there. And then also all the funding projects have to be monitored, has to be tracked. And we haven't added any staff over the last years. We've, in fact, reduced staff just through attrition. And so this is something to help support those requests. So.
Thank you. Come over here to Beth Holbrook.
Thank you again. I just wanted to talk about the Olean Walker Housing Loan Fund gap financing request, the $10 million ongoing. Just to remind people that we have not really done any substantial increases for Olean Walker for some time, and I think that there's an opportunity there. There's still financing gaps for any large projects. The supply chain has really not recovered fully since COVID, or I guess technically pre-COVID days. And I just wanted to iterate that I do think that this has the value to kind of address multiple categories along this, and so I wanted to articulate that. And then I also support the administrative structures. I think that that's going to be a real key component to making sure that we are staying abreast of that. Oh, thank you. Am I leading right into that, or are you? Perfect. Thank you, Christina.
Over, so I figure at certain points you want me to jump
in. Yeah, very good. So we're kind of concluding. We appreciate Wayne Niederhauser's work and preparation and the presentation, the request that he summarized. It looks like we can now move forward here for a further discussion specifically about the Olean Housing Walker Loan Fund.
Correct. Okay. So as our chairwoman of the Olean stated, we haven't had ongoing gap financing as far as I can see back in our near-term history. So the legislature has been great enough to give us $5 million in 1 year and $10 million in another. Unfortunately, there's no ongoing source. So for small projects, there's no ability for the Olean Walker to help unless they're really utilizing federal funds, which increase the cost significantly. We have to deal with a number of issues once we hit 11 units with federal funds. Davis-Bacon gets triggered, all the fun federal things that we have to do get triggered. The other unfortunate reality with utilizing these, it's about just over $6 million per year in federal funds, is the environmental review process that must happen before a speck of dirt is moved. In our smaller communities that maybe aren't as staffed up as well as they could be or might be, might should be, I guess would be the best way to put it. These ERRs are overlooked frequently, leaving us with small communities coming to us with a $1 million gap in their budget, and smaller projects just aren't getting funded. Furthermore, low-income housing tax credits, whether they're federal or they're state, plus private activity bonding, this is a significant cost to the borrower and the equity receiver. Small projects cannot float that type of cost. So this is the one funding source that they come to in order to plug a gap. They'll go to their RDAs, they'll go to the cities, they'll get donated land, but they're still funding that they cannot procure through existing resources. So we have this sort of dead zone, and that's where this would be utilized, which is how it was utilized when we received the one-time funding.
So. Thank you for the explanation. Is there any further discussion or questions about the proposal? Yes, let me please proceed.
Thank you, Nick Berger. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just to add on to that, these funds are critical for helping to service those needs in our rural communities as well. I think of one project that was just approved by the Olin Walker. It just would not have happened without this type of support, and it's our rural communities that suffer, it seems, the most without this type of financing available to them. They cannot afford, nor will they attract the equity that tax credits provide to projects in larger metros. So this is critical to those communities as well. So I'm in support.
Thank you. Do we have any comments or questions from anyone online? Okay, seeing none. Just for clarification, the request is being made. What is the amount, and is it one time or ongoing?
Correct. So the request would be $10 million ongoing, and this is a loan product. So we go anywhere from 0% to 2.5%, depending on what the structure of the financing can handle. And it does come back as program income. So every time we get a payment in the system, we package it with other funds that we potentially are getting additional payments for in state dollars, which is de minimis right now. And then we further provide those fundings out into the community.
Mr. Chair, I'm ready to make a motion.
Yes, please proceed.
I would like to make a move that I would like to make a motion that the Commission on Housing Affordability recommend the following budget priorities to the UEOC. They're going to be making more. They want more money. I'll hold.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Seeing no further questions or clarification about the Olin Walker Housing Loan Fund proposal, let's transition to the third aspect of this, which is the housing preservation request.
Michael Parker, I believe you're online, and Hunter.
Yep, Hunter here. Hunter Stratton, I'm the Director of Operations for the Utah Housing Preservation Fund. So just a quick update from the fund. Can everyone hear me okay, by the way?
Yes, you sound good. Okay. Thanks for joining.
Awesome. So a little quick update from the fund is we currently have 9 properties. We have 7 in Salt Lake County, 1 in Tooele, and 1 in Summit County. We are sitting at 644 units, and our average AMI is 52%. So we're here asking for $25 million one time. And also, we currently have raised, what is it now, $156 million. That's how big the fund is currently. And we are going through this year. We have been having some problems with some acquisitions due to the market. We currently looked at about 30 different deals and sent about 10 different offers in. And so we're confident, though, that this coming year we'll be able to get some more deals and obtain some more units. And with that, I'll pass it to Michael Parker.
Hello, all my good friends and Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair. Good to be with you and representing the Preservation Fund this morning. I'm speaking to the budget request for this coming year. This commission and the state, particularly the legislature, has been a terrific champion and partner of the Preservation Fund. Candidly, it would not be happening without that initial $2.5 million that the legislature helped put in to attract the Ivory Capital, the Zions Capital, and Intermountain Capital that then we leveraged with debt and began the process of preserving housing in our state at scale. The second point I would just say to all of you is you should be as proud as I am of this fund, because I truly believe this is a community effort. I see Janice on here who helped do our first deal. And as I've seen the fund grow over the last 4 years to now, where it preserved almost 17% of Summit County's affordable housing on its last deal it did. Can you imagine what Summit County and Park City would be doing without the Utah Housing Preservation Fund in the mix? Those are the key opportunities and the right opportunities for the Preservation Fund to operate within. Lastly, I just want to touch on the unique nature of this fund. Number one, this is likely the nation's best preservation fund in operation. I can say that as somebody that's been looking at housing innovation across this country for the last 4 years. I credit Clark Ivory for his vision and his business acumen in this space for understanding the potential of a tool like this. I credit partners like we spoke to, like Intermountain. Excuse me. That was a good frog. Intermountain, Zions Bank, and others who saw the potential of a fund and a collaborative effort. And more importantly, I would just say the ability for this fund to execute at scale, one, has become difficult, as Hunter's mentioned, because of just the real estate environment. And candidly, sellers who think their property might be a lot more worth 2 years ago than it was what it is today, and especially that B and C tier properties that we target highly, those sellers are anxious to see where the market is going. And so those deals have been harder to get to a closing period. That being said, as we enter into this next phase around the interest rate environment, the real estate environment, the fund's investment committee has been very judicious with our resources. And we have substantial cash resources to go put to work, including more than $30 million of private capital ready to go. We have additional private capital that's willing to be called. And the state making a continued large commitment to this as our state's primary preservation effort is why this request is coming at $25 million, which matches the state's top line for appropriations 2 years ago. It gave $25 million, and our investment committee has asked us to come here today and present this request of $25 million more. You will see that we match that with $75 million in private dollars. So a 3-to-1 ratio is what we've been matching the state. Candidly, we've been overmatching the state at probably a 6-to-1 ratio when debt's included. That debt financing allows us to take the $25 million that you produce on equity side and scale it with debt to about a $250 million impact. There aren't many investments and appropriations we can make where we get a 10-to-1 leverage off of those dollars. And then roughly speaking, in the market, between $180,000 and $250,000 per unit, which would be awesome if we could get down to that 180 number, although Lucas and team have looked at some in the 160, 170, 180, we look at about 1,200 additional affordable housing units. Let me contextualize this. Lucas and team have used a number, and Janice will know this well, around 6,000 units of tax credit properties are set to expire in the next 5 years. That's not naturally occurring housing. That's not all kinds of other housing that exists out in the market. That's only the ones we can see. So when we're here asking for 1,200 units to be preserved, we're talking about a fifth of what we can see, not to mention what we can't see with naturally occurring housing. And so I just encourage you to continue to maintain the momentum around this and open to any questions as you move this up to the UEOC.
Thank you very much for the preparation and the presentation for both of you and for joining us virtually today. Are there any questions or discussion regarding the Preservation Fund?
Yes.
Thank you for your presentation. Thank you for the time, Mr. Co-Chair. Quick question. What is the total capital of the Utah Housing Preservation Fund currently? What is the utilization? And what is this ask based on in terms of pipeline or just in terms of historical asks? So, many part question there. Forgive me if you caught it all. If not, I can repeat myself.
I think I caught parts of it, but Mr. Chair, can you just clarify who's asking the question, just for reference?
This is Nick Berger.
And Hunter, I think the first question speaking to cash on hand and ability to act.
Total capitalization, to be clear. What's the total capitalization of the Utah Housing Preservation Fund, and what's the total utilization?
So basically how much money we've raised and how much we've deployed, is that correct?
Correct.
All right, so total we have raised is $153 million, and then total deployed is $120 million.
And then speaking to your request, or where is this request based on? One, it's based on need. So as I spoke to the future in terms of lost units. Two, we have a set fund goal of raising to $250 million in equity. So we're more than 67% of the way towards our equity goal. And then in terms of deployment at scale, our initial goal was to preserve at least 5,000 units with the fund.
And do you anticipate the same type of matching dollars with this next round of $25 million?
Yes.
You do. So that would get you roughly, just in my own mind, that would get you to your goal then? This next 25 would get you to your goal?
I think that's correct.
Okay. All right. Based on, forgive me, may I
please proceed?
May I go on? Based on this, the preserving of the roughly 1,200 units, is there a report that gives us some statistics on what you're taking these units on per door? Just again, if you were to go 1,200, 250 million, so is it safe to assume that you're taking these down about $215,000 per door?
Correct. That's a good average, and I would say the market has moved, and we don't know where it's out necessarily in the next 3 months, but our range remains in that level.
Okay. That's it for a minute. I'm processing, so yeah, I open it up to any other questions.
Thank you. We'll come over to Beth Holbrook.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Michael, I did have a quick question. I'm just wondering if you could articulate the how far-reaching all of this is. In other words, what is the rural versus urban components, and how that structures or maybe plays into how you designate the housing pieces, the housing units?
So both the capital from the state and the investment committee governed by our fund documents and investors have a 70-30 focus, which matches the Olean Walker statute around urban versus rural. So just speaking to goal setting, we focus on a 30-70. Speaking to what is rural, that definition is the four urban counties. So when I say urban, I say Davis, Weber, Salt Lake, and Utah County. So you get Shoulder County investment of Tooele and Summit County. Now, you and I may not call that rural, but Olean Walker operates under that same current statutory definition. And I would encourage, as I have in other meetings, that that's something that's explored and refined. We have been working, and I should say the team has been working tirelessly to try and identify deals in rural Utah. And particularly in places like Cedar City, we've had several come through. Candidly, those sellers don't, the market's not hot enough in certain places for them to understand both the opportunity and the cost of them not partnering with the fund, if that makes sense, Beth. And so those deals have been harder to close, but we've had Senator Vickers, for example, the mayor of Cedar City, and others pen letters to those sellers trying to encourage them to participate in the fund. In St. George, we've looked at several, but again, I wouldn't necessarily look at St. George as a rural county, but under Olean Walker's definition, that's where it's at. Does that help, Beth?
That helps tremendously. Thank you so much.
But holistically, the need for preservation is much more intense in rural Utah, but it's almost a single family preservation strategy. And I don't know if our tool is best suited for that product type particularly. And I think it's a good policy question for the CHA to think about.
Please proceed. Just a couple more questions. Remind me, and I know you've presented to this group and in your materials, what are the deed restrictions that come with this grant and these funds? how long are these projects kept as affordable? Is it a land deed restriction, and how long does that go?
So I'll let Hunter speak to the technical deed restriction, but I'll just speak to the fund structure, which I think is important. So the fund's structured as an evergreen fund. This is why I would tell you it's a national model. It's structured under a 501c3 and Utah Nonprofit Housing Corporation. Mm-hmm. The evergreen structure means we don't sell assets. Technically, there's lots of preservation funds out and about, and many that do great work. They often have an investor with a term of 10 years, and so we get partial preservation is what we've called it, or not preservation at all, because you likely get a much more egregious rent increase at the back end of that 10 years when that investor would like their capital back. The unique structure of the preservation fund with evergreen and staggered investments from all our investors, which includes several of our industrial banks, which is one of the first funds to tap their CRA requirements, and others, has allowed us to spread it so we don't have exits that require a sale of an asset. That's super important to perpetual preservation. Now, speaking to a legal deed restriction, Hunter's much closer to that and can speak to that.
Yes, Michael hit that really well. For the deed restriction, we'll work with the counties. It depends on what county. So every time we acquire a property, it's dependent on the property and the county, and we'll work with them. But we aim for a deed restriction, again, to try to protect these properties for the rest of their useful life. So whatever that would be. And then also we also deed restrict the rents as well. So we're making sure that we're aiming to help the people that need it the most, around 65% and lower.
I think the term is between 20 and 40 years.
Correct.
Thank you. That was my question. So how long? So I don't want to be in the can kicking business, like you said before, in the 10-year deal. So 20 to 40 years. It would be good to report what the average duration of those restrictions are. I would like to know that. And then just so you don't think I'm busting your chops the whole time, I touch between 30 and 40 LIHTC deals a year. And those deals are coming in between almost $450,000 per unit.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can preserve a unit at $215,000 per unit on average, that is a value to us, the state, the taxpayer. That's money very well spent in my opinion.
Appreciate those comments. And awesome. Just to pile on to them, the speed to market of preservation cannot be beat. So it takes several years to pull together a LIHTC deal, from the financing deals to the zoning to the building of the product. So your speed to market of delivering new units is very long. We need as many new units as we can get because we have a shortage. But if we're having a leaky bucket of the existing units that are far more cheaper and we can preserve far more quickly, then we're just doing self-harm.
Thank you. That was a good discussion and questions regarding Preservation Fund. Before we move forward, is there anyone online that has a question? Seeing none. Okay.
Oh, Janice, Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Kimball has a point.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I didn't see you. Please proceed.
Thanks, Michael, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for Michael. So you said it was $215 a door. Is that to purchase? Does that include any renovations that are needed, or would that be an addition?
I can answer that one, Michael.
Okay, go ahead.
So it is it's with improvements as well.
Nice. Thank you.
Yes.
I would just share with you, Hunter, Lucas, and the team we have behind them on acquisition, it's a true Utah fund. We have private sector expertise around a nonprofit mission and purpose. And so the underwriting they do on these properties, one, from a cash flow perspective to make sure the fund is whole long term, is extremely important. And then two, Janice, that's a huge potential for municipalities and others to participate with us. So as we go in and underwrite a project and see a gap on renovations, that's a great potential for home grant dollars, CBDG dollars, other ways for them to fit in. But, yes, we're baking that into our assumptions as far as purchase price.
Thank you. Well, I believe that concludes the presentations and the different aspects of the funding update from the working group. We appreciate this working group for the many meetings that they've had through the summer, almost on a weekly basis, to be able to get things to this point. So in summary, we've heard presentations about from Wayne Niederhauser, about multiple aspects, as well as the Olin Walker, the Preservation Fund, and some requests for FTEs as well. So I believe we're at a point, the end of the kind of maybe discussion and questions, and we can go back to Senator Fillmore's original motion.
Thank you.
And if we can ask the staff to take very careful notes, as we want to make sure we capture this perfectly.
Thank you. I also would like to express my gratitude to the working group for coming back with this proposal. I like it. We're still asking for the moon, but maybe not the moon and the stars. All right. So I recommend that this committee recommend the following budget priorities to the UEOC. Number one, in ongoing, permanent supportive housing at $15 million. Number two, Olin Walker gap financing of $10 million. Number three, homeless mitigation at $2.5 million. And number four, HCD support staff at $318,000. In one time, a priority number one of deeply affordable housing of $50 million. Number two, housing preservation at $25 million. And funding from a new source of $39 million for whatever the one that was left over that I didn't write down. Yeah. Yeah, the dedicated funding source for homelessness. $39 million from a new funding source, not, right? So it doesn't need to come from existing, ongoing, or one time. We'll find a source for that. That's my motion.
Thank you. The following motion is before us, as articulated by Senator Fillmore. Is there any discussion or questions to the motion?
Just quick clarification, yes. Senator Fillmore. Is that your prioritization list as well? I'm assuming,
yes,
that's why you were so detailed in that.
Yes.
Okay. Would you consider moving up the Housing Community Development Support Staff as one having interacting with them? I think it's a small ask, and it would be critical to those that work with them to make sure that they get the staff they need in order to help everybody else. It's a choke point in the services area.
You are welcome to make a substitute motion.
Okay. Then I would make a substitute motion to move that ongoing staff funding up and up to, I don't remember what.
I had it at number four. You might want to move it to number three and move homeless mitigation at $2.5 million down to number four.
Boy, that makes me sound terrible. I don't know. I think the chances of it going through are strong anyway. So I think I will amend my, let's just stick with your prioritization.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Anyone online? Seeing none, it is proposed that we prioritize those items according that's been really carefully articulated by staff and by the team here. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion unanimously passes. That will now move forward to the next step of presenting those recommendations to the UEOC. Thank you for that good conversation, robust conversation, especially needed as we're talking about such a large amount of significant taxpayer money. So thank you. Okay, we're going to go back up on the agenda to the Libertas Institute presentation about legal starter homes by Lee Sands. Invite you to please come forward and also introduce yourself at the beginning of the presentation. We are also looking and want to be cognizant of the other agenda items. The meeting will conclude at 3:00 in an hour. We have several other items to discuss, and so appreciate everyone's conciseness, but also having a good, robust presentation and conversation.
Okay, thank you, Chair White, Chair Fillmore, members of the commission. Thank you for taking this time to listen to our presentation. My name is Lee Sands. I'm the local government policy analyst at the Libertas Institute. And what we're going to be doing today, what we're presenting on, is basically giving you guys a summary of a policy brief that I researched and authored about 6 months ago. And the topic is on starter homes. And so figuring out how we get more starter homes constructed, that is the basic structure of the presentation. I'm joined by my friend Greg Brooks, from the Better Cities Project, and then I'll let him do a quick introduction.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair, members of the Commission. Better Cities Project is a national nonpartisan nonprofit. We're based in Nevada, but our sole focus is putting practical, ready-to-implement solutions into the hands of cities and counties. We work with about little over 10,000, between 10,000 and 11,000 mayors, city council members, and county commissioners who receive toolkits, ready-to-run model ordinances, and a variety of input. One of the reasons I'm so excited about being involved in this project with Libertas is, well, it's twofold, really. Lee and I share a common vision that housing is adjacent to virtually every other problem that local and state government seeks to get involved with. If you care deeply about economic resilience and growth in your communities, housing's a part of that. If you care about helping the homeless, as we've just heard, housing is a part of that. You can go down the list. It goes on and on. But what we are excited to talk about today is a policy framework that's based on the reality on the ground here. Next slide, please. This is Utah's housing situation summed up very, very simply. Shortages create bidding wars. Bidding wars drive up prices. That hurts everybody. But next slide, please. To get a sense of the problem, and I feel compelled, may I? This is an overview of a detailed policy proposal. I encourage everybody in the room, really, to grab a copy of this on the way out, but we're going to keep it high level to stay within the time. The average home price in Utah has more than doubled in a fairly short amount of time. Less than 17% of Utah households can afford that new average. And so whatever else we do with housing, addressing the need for to drive that number down, not by affecting existing home prices, but driving it down through lowering the cost of new construction, is a key component of that. Next slide, please. Just quick show of hands from the commission. How many of you go on Zillow and just look around, whether you're buying or not? Okay, those of you who didn't raise your hand, it's okay not to admit it. Maybe it's the space I'm in, but it's a bit of a compunction. This is a straw man that is relevant to Utah. Somebody with $80,000 in annual income and a down payment of $50,000 can only afford a house up to $350,000 and change. Now, we can quibble about that number. Does it include PMI? Does it mean an adjustable rate loan or a fixed rate loan? The details don't matter. The fact that somebody earning $80,000 is that far out of line with the average single home price in Utah is the problem. Next slide. So let's put faces on this. Who makes $80,000 a year? Well, a lot of police officers and a lot of sheriffs make that much. Teachers in Utah make an average of about $54,000 per year. And young families who maybe grew up in Utah, love it here, want to stay here, but can't stay here, often make $80,000 a year or less. These are the people that these proposals are here for. Next slide, please. The solution, we believe part of the solution, is to legalize starter homes with small lot reform. I'm going to turn it back to Lee so he can get into the weeds on that.
Yeah, thank you, Greg, for that kind of introduction to the situation that we have. And if you advance to the next slide, please. I just want to be clear that what we're talking about today in this presentation are starter homes, and there's no official definition for starter home, but it's generally understood to be a smaller house on a smaller lot that those with middle-class incomes can actually afford. Right, your first home, not the most expensive homes in the market, not necessarily, the fixer uppers of the world, but that first starter home. And I have some pictures as I did my research that represent homes that if they were placed in various cities and counties throughout Utah, they would actually be illegal. When I say illegal, what I mean is the underlying zoning doesn't allow for it. That's when I use that term,
and
illegal.
Lee, these are actual homes?
Yes. There's,
these aren't – you didn't go to ChatGPT to generate these.
I did not generate these with ChatGPT, although when they do, this will make my life a lot easier.
And then are these in Utah?
These are not.
Okay.
These are not. They're more illustrative of what we're talking about, right? If you'll notice the blue one on the top right, that's a very skinny lot. What would make that where that would run up against with zoning is the width of the lot, right? So each one of these examples has something about it that under current zoning restrictions that I've analyzed, you know.
We have 248.
Yeah, 248. Is
it illegal in all of those, most of those?
I would say some aspect.
Okay.
I've looked at the minimum lot size of every city in Utah. I have a spreadsheet with it. But essentially, the cottage homes you see on the bottom right, those are very close together and they're kind of arranged. That is very, very difficult to find in a zoning code that explicitly allows it. It has to come through as a planned unit. Some of the homes you see, they are close to the property line. So being 3 and 4 feet to the property line, I've seen 10 feet is a very common setback or distance from the property line that it has to be. So I just wanted to make it crystal clear with this slide about what we would like to see the market be able to construct.
And to be clear, they're all detached homes. These proposals have nothing to do with planned unit developments, nothing to do with multi-story development, condos, things of that nature.
Yeah, and that's just for me, as I analyzed things, I thought, wow, you know, every house costs more than $500,000, practically speaking. You know, I wonder if the market could deliver something less. And it turns out the answer is yes, if, and that's where we get to the next slide. Yeah, and this is a bit small, but I can just walk you through it verbally. The notion of, oh, sorry, one of the research points that I found was that here in Utah's population center, so Wasatch Front, St. George, the average price for a half-acre lot is $300,000, so between $200,000 and $400,000. There's a difference between whether or not it's subbed for utilities or not already, but roughly speaking, that 300,000 half-acre lot number, I haven't had anyone tell me that that's just way off. And I was just looking on Zillow for vacant lots. And so essentially one of the big takeaways is that if we don't allow for smaller lots, if $300,000 is the starting price for the lot itself, affordability is almost impossible. Because if you look at the image of the starter home that's just to the left of that little lot graphic. That's a 3-bed, 2-bath, 3-bed, 2.5-bath, about 1,400 square feet with construction costs at 200 a square foot. I mean, do the math there, right? That's well above 500,000 for a new home. However, the alternative, if you let people subdivide their lots down to 1/8 of an acre lots and you give them the freedom to have the smaller setbacks, kind of scoot the home closer to the road a little bit, right? You can get the price of the lot to $75,000. So now we're talking, right? You take the $75,000, add it to the $278,000, and on the next slide is where it kind of shows this math that I did. Great, thank you. Yeah, you can see the math kind of in the bottom right-hand corner there. You know, $353,800. Now, does that include impact fees? No. Does that include, you know, the ability for the person to have a larger down payment? No. This is more of a conceptual math here that's being shown. But the idea is that someone with an annual income around $75,000 or the 80,000 number that we were referencing earlier, they could qualify for a loan for that home. So, in other words, what we'd like to propose that cities consider is making a lot of that size one of their minimum lot sizes. That's essentially what we're presenting about here. We can go to the next slide to put a little more information on it. Yeah, so the
one back, please.
Yeah, this is the There we go. Thank you so much. The second proposal that I talk about in the brief is legalizing lots that are as small as 1/16 of an acre to allow for cottage court development. That's kind of the name I've heard for this. You may have heard it called cluster homes or bungalow courts, I think is kind of the old school name for it. But the idea is if you have these really small lots, kind of a micro lot centered around a shared amenity, you can get the price of the land down even further. And on a much smaller lot, you basically can't even fit anything larger than maybe a 3-bed, 2-bath on it, which kind of addresses the question of, well, why aren't there more developers building, you know, starter homes? Well, if you mandate the big lot, then the incentive remains to put a big house on it. Where if you allow the land to be subdivided down, you can put these smaller starter homes. So essentially, that's kind of the quick version of the policy brief that I authored. And that's really the main idea that I wanted to get across is that if we can have smaller lots, we can have a greater variety of homes on the market. But the next slide, please. Yeah. And then again, this is just walking through the same math and, the annual income to qualify about 50,000. So teachers, there you go. That's kind of
right.
Kind of the idea there.
Next slide, please.
And let me be clear. So we've been talking about what cities can do. One of the main points I wanted to get across is that we don't feel that the state should come in and just mandate these small lots. We feel the right approach is actually encouraging the cities to do this of their own choice and the state providing some assistance. And another key point that I need to make on this, don't mandate anything. This is not forcing anyone to subdivide their lot, right? If someone doesn't want to subdivide their lot down, they don't do it, right? And so we're not, a small lot reform is not a mandate from the government. That's just one key point that's what that slide there is to remind me that we're not talking about, state preemption, pure state preemption, and we're not talking about, forcing people to subdivide their lots.
Next slide, please.
And as we are probably needing to wrap up the presentation to meet the other agenda items, if we could ask you to summarize concisely the remaining points.
You can absolutely do it. You can skip this slide that just summarizes. This is what I want to close on. Cities can adopt either of the reforms we've just talked about. Yes, it probably includes tweaking things like setbacks and stuff, but there's no reason any city in Utah can't adopt those now. What the state can do is use carrots to encourage that behavior. We believe that small lot reform could potentially be a form of enhanced compliance for the moderate income housing requirements. Cities that undertook small lot reform could get priority access to pools of state funding, which is in line with the way the requirements work now. And just from a paperwork viewpoint, because we heard earlier in the presentation that it was dealing with the moderate income housing requirements was a choke point, we believe that this enhanced level of compliance should probably come with a reporting holiday of several years for cities that choose to undertake it. Next slide, please. This one speaks for itself. Housing too often is about the numbers, the math, the calculated need of the community. We're in the business of doing some of that, but we're also in the business of waking up every day saying, who can we help? And we believe that there is a path forward for the state and the cities working together without mandates to help millions of Utah residents achieve the dream of home ownership. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
In your presentation, you had mentioned that you had some examples, but in order for this to happen currently, it would have to be a PUD. Is that a problem?
It's not a problem. In fact, I think having, developers come in with things that are even variations, of what we described is what we're looking for, right? So I would say it's not a problem. It would be really helpful for the individual homeowner who has maybe a full acre who wants to maybe subdivide it. Right, a PUD for one homeowner, that's kind of where the by right sure. aspect of this kind of comes in to be a big help.
Okay. Mr. Stans, thank you for preparing the policy brief and looking at ways to be able to increase the number of homes, the supply of homes in the state that are affordable for first-time home buyers, and presenting the data, the analysis, and some recommendations as well. And Mr. Brooks, thank you for joining and being here as well and for your work today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm grateful for the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to jump back because we have a full quorum with us right now for approval of the meeting minutes of June 6th and August 1st of this year. A motion would be appropriate. Could Beth, may we ask you?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd like to make a motion that we approve the meeting minutes of June 6, 2023 and August 1st, 2023 as written.
Thank you. The motion before us is to approve those minutes of June 6 and August 1st, 2023. Discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Thank you. Any opposed? Thank you. That motion unanimously passes where the meeting minutes have been approved. Let's move to our next agenda item of the policy update from the working group. I believe we'll turn the microphone to Chris Gambrulis.
Actually, while I get him on.
Sure. Before we move to the policy update, let's go to the data update, and we'll turn the time to Christina.
Thank you, Representative. I don't have a lot of updates from the last time that we met because the work product is still in progress. So we still are waiting for the finalization, which will be Q4 of 2023, closer to the end, closer to the legislative session. So we will be looking at the moderate income housing needs supply demand database, inventory of existing programs and policies, for sale product at certain price points, and housing authority data. So those are still in process, and the information is being gathered. We should be able to disseminate it here, hopefully before Christmas.
Okay. Thank you for that update. Any questions or discussion regarding the data update? Anyone online? Okay. Seeing none, thank you. Boy, we appreciate the data working group working throughout the summer, almost on a weekly basis as well, to be able to help us have the data points to be able to make good data-driven decisions going forward. Let's come back now to the agenda item of our working group with our policy update. And Chris Gambrulis, we'll turn the time to you, the microphone to you, to represent the policy discussions that have been taking place.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you loud and clear. Thank you.
McKenna, can you let me do a screen share?
All right. Chris, you can share your screen now.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, you know, there's been all a lot of love in the meeting today, a lot of interest in really great, you know, opportunities to look at funding and some other policy issues. And unfortunately, I'm here to rain on everyone's parade and tell you that this is going to be not widely embraced, but important, and an important conversation for us to have. And there's a lot of words on the screen, but the bottom line is that as a practitioner of land development for 30 years in the state of Utah, being involved in developing primarily residential real estate for three decades, where the challenges occur in meetings, where they become contentious is, generally speaking, it is in the rezoning hearings. And when a general plan map reflects a long-term planning goal for an area of a city or a specific property, if there is a process that is a legislative process after that, and that is the rezoning process, that is where you get the NIMBYism. And NIMBYism doesn't happen at the city level generally, unless it's a smaller community. And, you know, our experience at Cottonwood Mall was a citywide thing, but it's a city of 25,000 people. It's a smaller community. And you look at what happened in that process. The reality is that what will be built there will be okay, but it won't be great. And it's because of this rezoning process that is legislative. And this is not a, you know, for land use policy wonks, this is, you know, they love this stuff. But this is a really important thing to understand that if you could do a general plan at a city level, which cities are supposed to already do, and adopt it by ordinance, then when it came time, even if the property wasn't rezoned from, say, agricultural to some kind of residential or some kind of a transition zone into an industrial or whatever, that event is an administrative event. That is not a small distinction. It's a very important distinction. And this is already in the law. The cities are supposed to do this. Like this is, I just pulled this out of the state code, right? Like they're already, the land use element is already supposed to provide for these things. And the challenge is that, and then this is of course from the MIHP plan. And I will tell you, you'll hear me say this a lot, NIMBYism is hyper-local. It typically doesn't happen at a city level. Like in Salt Lake City, our project, the Ivory Homes project in the Avenues, there was a recent NIMBY letter to the editor in yesterday's paper, you know, saying that, you know, the Avenues, which is one of the most diverse locations in the state in terms of demographics and housing product and missing middle and on and on and on, that my gosh, that this project is like sardines in a can. And this is a property between a townhome community and a condominium building, a six-story condominium building. And that this one property in the Avenues is where, you know, we draw the line for sardines in a can. And that's what happens with NIMBYism. It's hyper-local. It becomes neighborhood by neighborhood. It becomes street by street. And the challenge is that when cities are making decisions, zoning decisions, on hyper-local properties, that it's the 30 people that come to the meeting, and there might be two people that spend their time coming to say something good about it, and everyone else is worked up, and then, you know, you just get this kind of pushback. But if that meeting was an administrative meeting where the city had actually done their general plan the way the law says they're supposed to, and they do all the missing middle and the small lot stuff that you just heard Lee talk to you about, you know, all of the stuff that, like, smaller lots and smaller setbacks, things that you've heard us talking about, they put it, you know, in a great presentation. All of those things, when that time comes, like our property in the Avenues, where we're talking about twin homes and single family homes on small lots, generating, you know, hundreds of signs in the neighborhood. But that meeting becomes administrative. So now what are the benefits of doing that? Well, it becomes legally binding and enforceable. And that means the property owner can require it. It means a neighbor. It means that somebody gets to enforce that if a land use authority doesn't follow. It provides clarity. Like, wouldn't that be a good thing if a general plan is, if every part of the general plan is adopted by ordinance, except for the land use plan, and that's just advisory, then Why does the transportation plan get adopted by ordinance? Why does the sewer plan get adopted by ordinance? If you can play with the density numbers, how do you know you've sized your infrastructure right? How do you know you've got the right water tanks and the right sewer sizes? But what about those landowners? And what about the people that live next to it? It doesn't preclude amendments over time. It doesn't take the public out of the process. It just moves it up. It just happens earlier. And, you know, these zoning hearings truly are, they have become very emotional. And I've seen them over 3 decades of this. Now, what are the pitfalls of this? Well, I've been told we're going to get dumbed down general plans. The cities are just going to take their general plan and they're going to downzone the whole city and dumb it down. And then everything else will be back to an upzone. And in that case, I say, well, maybe you shouldn't be planning. Like, if you're not going to follow the law that says you have to do this and you're just going to play around with this, well, then maybe there should be other, you know, there should be other outcomes. They might enact zoning other land use codes that have the effect of prohibiting things like additional parking requirements, additional setback requirements that, you know, you can do this, but you have to do it in these boxes. And once you like do the Rubik's Cube over here, you realize that you actually can't achieve that goal. And so that is a pitfall. That's a potential thing we have to be concerned about. The 2 year old, I mean, every 2 years there's elections and that could become unwieldy. I'm not saying this is a panacea. I'm just saying that I'm telling you what some of the arguments are against this that I think we need to think about. Not everybody wants to follow the general plan, even the developers, even if there's a perceived benefit. But everybody gets to participate. So now this is part of the formula for how do you do what you can do to make it be effective. Well, one of those is that there's just penalties. That why should a land use authority that is granted power, authority, not rights. Remember, governments don't have rights. People have rights. But they have powers and duties. And their powers and duties are to plan and to do these things in this way. What happens if they don't do it? Why should there be no penalty to that? And so one of the penalties could be a financial penalty. You could simply add it in. It's already in 1343-206-12 in the Office of Property Rights Ombudsman statute. You could add in that if you go through that process, there could be compensatory or consequential damages. What about an appeal authority for a general plan? Now I know we're getting into other things like what is there a regional planning authority? Well, we already have regional planning authorities, don't we? We've got MPOs. The P in MPO actually stands for planning. The governor's office of planning and budget already has a P in it. So we already have entities. I'm not saying that they want to do this or that they're set up to do this today. But what if there was a land use map that didn't comply with all of this? Well, maybe, who do you appeal it to? Maybe you go to the courts. I don't know. I know courts don't want to make a decision on whether a map meets those requirements, and they're going to give broad discretion to land use authority, right? So maybe that there's some planners in the room that can do that. California, and I hate to say, you know, use California in a good way, other than they have a beautiful state, but you know, they have a thing called a builder remedy where if you exhaust all of your other remedies, go to court and municipality still isn't playing fair, then you have a by right. You've got a development by right. And then loss of funding and other things. And why would you want to do this? Well, you would be driving at the, you know, planning outcomes that are already in the statute. I think what Lee talked to you about today, you know, with this legalizing small lots, it's really interesting stuff about these small lots, and then we're talking about maximizing the two most precious resources we have, our land and our water, the physical resources. And how do you do that? Well, you have to think through how do you make that legal, right? Like make those small lots legal, and then also make them buildable so that you're conscious of what your setbacks are, what your parking standards are. And then even some of these water-wise landscaping techniques and how do we minimize those. So those are, that's the background. I know that co-chairs, and particularly last week at the UEOC presented a really high level around this, but this is where the policy group is heading. No, there's not consensus. I readily acknowledge that there is not general consensus among the land use authorities, basically the league and their membership, the UAC and their membership, and then other interested parties at the table. But I think that these are worthy of discussion, and I think that even with the potential pitfalls, we can learn from what other jurisdictions and other states have done and save ourselves a lot of those headaches. One last point. When I've talked to people from Oregon and California who've been engaged in these conversations and there's a lot, there's online, there's blogs and Twitter feeds and all sorts of things. And when you engage with people that have been on the ground and you say, why not this? Why not a planning solution? They say, well, we just couldn't get to yes. So what they did, particularly in California and Oregon, Minneapolis, Montana did it in certain areas, is they said, we're just going to upzone the whole state. And now you can put three plexes or four plexes anywhere you want. And I'm speaking for Chris Gambrulis now, representing the Homebuilders Association. I don't think that that's the best planning outcome in my professional opinion as a professional residential land developer for three decades. I don't think just haphazardly putting three plexes and four plexes everywhere is a good solution. I'm okay with general plans and looking at those things. I'm not saying that that's not a possibility for infill development, but they just did it wholesale, and I'm not sure it's going to result in the best built environment outcome. And so that's why I'm leaning more towards this. I think that we can get together. I know that there's a lot of people who have a lot of strong opinions about this both ways. And I'm happy to hear them all, but that's the real background of what the policy committee has been debating.
Thank you very much for presenting and providing an update about the work that the policy working group has been spending a lot of time on this summer discussing. Let's open it up for any discussion or questions about any of the policy ideas that are being discussed right now for additional clarification. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Chris, this is Beth Holbrook. I wasn't sure you could see it was me. I thank you so much for, I know we have had many discussions about how we're all trying to be very strategic when we look at how we're going to develop out, and we look at what can we do structurally to make the most impact and maximize the utilization of resources, right? I mean, because that is a really strong goal. And I think that's a lot of people get behind that. A lot of cities get behind that. I think that there's a good understanding of this is going to ultimately value our long-term economic growth and our growth patterns in general, because we know we're going to continue to grow. I do understand some of the challenges that some cities have had in terms of working with developers. I'm trying to be
strategic, I guess, even when I say this. But I do think that some of the proposals, I think, could maybe not be the best solution as a policy, but more as a an element of if we enact legislation. So you referenced House Bill 462, which I think, and I'm biased, I think that that's really great legislation, and I think that the CHA deserves a lot of credit for really initiating this discussion. And I think we should continue to let that strategic development and strategic zoning and land use continue to evolve a little bit more. I think that now that we've had some teeth put into some of the moderate income housing plan requirements, I would really like to see how these kind of structure out. I think we've seen some good investments in state funding for HTRZ locations, all talking about density and how we can maximize our resources and infrastructure, which I'm all for, but I'm not quite sure I'm ready to commit to what some of this policy discussion that you have. But again, I want to appreciate the work and the effort that this group has done.
Thank you. We'll turn the time to you, Ginger.
Hi, Chris. Ginger Chin, Salt Lake Chamber, as you know. I have a question. You put on your slides about appeal authority. What would that look like? And what do the planning organizations think about that appeal authority piece?
Well, you saw I had a lot of question marks up.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm trying to in brief conversations, it has been I'll let them speak for what their position is. I wouldn't say it's supportive, but I wouldn't necessarily say I've heard, you know, hardcore negatives. More like what does that look like? And what my purpose in raising that, Ginger, was to present an idea of a way to do that without all of the answers, but recognizing that there are still things that we don't know and that we're going to have to answer. But I think an all hands on deck approach to this is better than just the checkerboard approach that we've had over time. And I think we've lost a lot of opportunities.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, discussion from anyone online? Seeing none, if I may come back and ask a follow-up question, Chris, going back to one of the policy questions, one of the strategic underlying questions we're asking is, will the policy proposal result in more housing units that are directly affordable to the buyer or the renter? With the policies that are being discussed right now, how will that policy proposal result in more housing units that are directly affordable?
Representative White, going back to the one slide that I showed where I pulled out the language that's currently in the statute, there's already a requirement in state code in 109A403 that land use authorities plan for this, but there is nothing that that requires it, or where there is no accountability for it. And that's the nexus that I'm trying to create here, is that you've got this requirement, but if you can't enforce it, then it may or may not result in that. But I think if there's an enforcement mechanism to get that, you know, location of land for housing for residents of various income levels, and you can actually show that in a general plan, you can say that you plan for it, and that working towards that goal, I believe that over time you will end up with more than you would get otherwise, because right now it's catch as catch can. And I think we need to be more intentional about it.
Thank you. Is there any further questions? Now, recognizing the policy working group has many individuals and organizations that are a part of this, being a part of this discussion. Up to this point, we haven't reached a consensus or everyone on the same page. There's been really good dialogue, discussion, debate about the different pros and cons with each of the different items that have been just provided to us today. Those will, I anticipate, continue and need to continue for us to be able to move forward a recommendation to the upcoming legislative session. I would propose, and Senator Fillmore and I would propose, that we have another Commission on Housing Affordability meeting before the next UEOC meeting, which is on October the 18th, to be able to allow this working group a little bit more time to come together to present a proposal to see if at that time if there's consensus. If there's not consensus, understanding what the proposals are and make a determination of how or if they would proceed with the next legislative session. We don't have a date maybe to propose right now, but if we can, we'll look at some potential dates before October 18th and be able to publicly share that date. And that meeting, primarily the agenda items, would be policy proposals, so we can have a recommendation from the CHA moving forward with the UEOC. Any discussion or concerns about having another CHA meeting before October 18th? Okay, seeing none, we'll move forward with that way and be able to let everyone know when we're able to coordinate schedules to do that. We just really appreciate everybody on these policy questions. It's been described to me and several of us in the room over this last year that over the last, boy, 6-7 years, a lot of the low-hanging fruit policy issues and topics have really been addressed. What's before us right now are really big questions, big, hard, difficult, complex questions of about a policies that we be able to help address the issues in the state. So thank you for everybody's involvement with those discussions, and we'll be back for the next CHA meeting where we'll be able to coalesce and come forward with a policy recommendation. Chris, thank you for your presentation, for the update, and for everybody's involvement. I believe we're at the next agenda item. If there's any other business that should be brought up at this time. Okay, seeing none, we have addressed the items here. We really appreciate everybody who's with us in person. Thank you for taking your afternoon and involvement with this, as well as everybody that's online and participating, especially for the staff, the full-time employees that are working, organizing, and keeping all of this forward. We appreciate all of you. There is a motion in order to adjourn. It has been moved to adjourn. That's non-negotiable. All in favor say aye.
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 Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. We hope everyone has a good afternoon.